reanimated by Deborah Solomon. Oye Disney, who has long been derided as Walt's idiot nephew, as he puts it, is actually an eloquent, thoughtful man, who completes the daily crossword in ink. Yet he does have a quirky sense of humor that he tends to unleash at his own expense. One recent afternoon, while we were sitting in his living room with his wife and his oldest son, I looked up from my notepad and was astonished to see him tugging on both ears, dangling his tongue from his mouth, and panting like an exhausted dog. "Did you know," he asked me, "that I was the model for Goofy?" At 74, Disney is an affable, gray-haired man, whose long face and squinty eyes lend him an uncanny likeness not to old Goofy, for whom he did not actually pose so much as to their mutual forebear Walt. His temperament, though, is closer to that of his father, Roy O. Disney, the kinder, gentler and lesser known of the entertainment empire's founders. Within the company, the younger Roy has always been viewed as an oddly nonchalant heir, indifferent to the seductions of power, content, to spend his days tinkering with films and keeping court with the old-time animators whom he had watched in his privileged boyhood, sketching scenes for Pinocchio and Fantasia on their storyboards. "When you grow up around a company in which the power is already yours," he explained that day at his home in Toluca Lake, a suburban section of Los Angeles, "you look at power in a different way. I believe that the work was the important thing. I wasn't political. I wasn't trying to nudge some guy out of the way." These days, however, Roy Disney is very intent on nudging a guy out of the way. He is trying, by his own admission, to destroy Michael D. Eisner, the chairman and chief executive of the company, and a man Disney himself helped hire in 1984. The rancor between the two men spilled into public view in November, after Disney invited one Friday afternoon to meet a fellow member of the board of directors at a bar in a Pasadena mall, was told that he was too old to be renominated for his longtime seat on the board. In a state he describes as deep shock, he calmly walked to the parking lot of the mall and called his wife from his car. When he arrived home, Patty Disney was choking back tears. "He was gray when he walked in," she told me. "He looked like he had been kicked in the stomach." 2 weeks later, on the Sunday of Thanksgiving weekend, Eisner was in New York, watching a pro football game in his Fifth Avenue apartment, when a 3-page letter was slipped under his door. In it, Disney offered his resignation as vice chairman of the board, and also forfeited his day-to-day job as the head of the company's feature animation division. He went on to pinpoint 7 problems at the company he said he believed were entirely Eisner's doing, ranging from the loss of creative energy to a drop-off in quality at properties like ABC and the theme parks to a general deficiency in leadership that Disney said had caused a perception that the company was soulless and rapacious. The letter concluded, "It is my sincere belief that it is you who should be leaving, and not me." On March 3, Eisner is scheduled to play host to the company's annual shareholders meeting at the Convention Center in Philadelphia, turning the city of brotherly love into a site of unbridled aggression. Roy Disney plans to hold his own reception the day before to welcome many of the 25,000-plus sympathizers who have so far signed on to SaveDisney.com, a website he founded to drum up support for his anti-Eisner effort. But when Eisner faces the shareholders, he will have more on his mind than Roy and his homespun campaign. 3 weeks ago, Pixar Animation Studios, which has created some of Disney's most profitable and artistic films in recent years, abruptly called off talks to extend its distribution deal with the company. And on February 11, Comcast Corporation, the country's largest cable operator, made a $54 billion hostile takeover bid for Disney, partly because Roy Disney's crusade against Eisner had helped create the impression that the chief executive and his company were vulnerable. By the end of last week, photographs of Eisner's solemn, square-jawed face were on newspaper front pages everywhere, and the Disney board had announced that it was considering the Comcast offer. "I think the bid is a validation of everything I have been saying for 2 years," Roy told me, "but as for the details, I am still evaluating them." Whether or not Eisner falls, the battle to oust him carries a symbolism all its own. for the Walt Disney Company is not just another lucrative film studio or creator of theme parks, it is an essential part of the American imagination. Since its founding in 1923, it has asked us to wish upon a star, to whistle while we work, to believe that our prince will someday come. It practically invented the idea of happy endings. But in reality, life does not resemble a fairy tale, even if your name is Roy Disney, the last man at the company connected by blood to its founders. I am so pained for Roy, Patty Disney, a short, blunt woman of 69, told me, as we sat in her living room. I would go over there and punch Michael out if my husband let me. I wish you had gotten that over with right at the start, Roy replied with a chuckle. We want to take Michael sailing. Joked the couple's son, Roy P. Disney, known as Patrick, a father himself, who lives around the corner and had dropped by his parents' house, to lend them moral support. Yes, Patty said. Scare him to death. You see, he doesn't have any hobbies, and he is terrified of boats. He's a xenophobe. He is afraid to leave the country. Our family has so many interests. But Michael is one-dimensional. He doesn't do anything. He doesn't even play golf. Roy Disney's family, whose worth has been estimated at more than $1 billion, might not exactly qualify as plain folk. And Roy Disney, who races yachts and drives a red Ferrari, who owns a castle in Ireland as well as a Boeing 737 jet, to fly him there, cannot fairly be described as salt of the earth. Yet on this shining winter afternoon, he and his family certainly seemed like the picture of normalcy as they sat in their comfy three-bedroom home, talking about the stock villain of domestic life, Dad's mean boss, with a mixture of outrage and sardonic humor. We're not fancy people, Patty said, adding that she runs her household on a modest budget and has no hired help, no chauffeur, no cook, no maid. She and the rest of the family seem eager to define themselves in opposition to the mythic excesses of Hollywood, perhaps because they are genuinely unshowy, or perhaps because their proprietary passions for the Walt Disney Company have led them to buy into its fabled emphasis on the common touch. You really need to touch the ground, Patrick said. My mother shops at Costco. She shops at Target. I do not shop there, Patty protested. You do too, Mom. Well, sometimes I do, Patty conceded. It's a great place to buy t-shirts. Patrick added, I make my kids stand in line at Disneyland. They stand in line for 2 hours just like everyone else. His father, who was sitting at the far end of the couch, observing the banter between mother and son, with visible amusement, he seems to suck out the social margins not only at work, but even within his own family, jumped into the conversation at the mention of the theme parks. I will promise you, Roy Disney said, there isn't a member of the Disney board who has ever stood in line at the parks. When they go, they get backdoored into everything. When we go to the parks, Patrick continued, if we see a candy wrapper on the ground, we stop and pick it up and put it in the trash. Do you think Michael would ever think of doing a thing like that? Oh, please, yes. These days, Michael Eisner is on the defensive, and some say he is in possession of a newly friendly and even solicitous personality. He has been meeting with major shareholders and stock analysts and giving little pep talks on his own behalf. His board has been rallying behind him, sending off letters to about a third of the company's 2.8 million shareholders that brim with good news about the stock price, while condemning the misleading and distorted campaign against him. When I called Eisner's office to request an interview in January, I was turned down. Instead, I was invited to visit company headquarters and talk to top executives so long as I agreed not to quote them by name in this article. We don't think we should be expletive on Roy in public, Xenia Mucha, Senior Vice President for Corporate Communications, said. Later that day, she emailed me some 20-odd articles chronicling the shortfalls of various companies held by Roy Disney, his associates, and his children. The gesture was surprisingly aggressive, particularly since Roy Disney is not mounting a full-blown proxy contest, which would require that he propose a successor, someone, anyone to replace Eisner. Instead, He has merely called for Eisner's removal, which, in corporate circles, tends to be viewed as roughly tantamount to a high school senior trying to topple the president of the student council by going around saying, he stinks. Disney's goal, he says, is to have at least 10-12% of shareholders withhold consent for Eisner's re-election before March 3, which he says he believes could sway the board to dump its famously entrenched chief. In the meantime, Eisner still reports to work at the Disney studio in Burbank, a squeaky clean sprawl of manicured lawns and squat brick buildings. The grounds look like Disneyland but without any people. Management occupies the Team Disney building, as it is called, which was designed by the architect Michael Graves as a playful exemplar of postmodernism. Outside, sculptures of the seven lowriffs serve as photoric columns that appear to be holding up the roof. The whole gang is on hand, including Dopey, in his pointy dunce cap, an underachiever and the sort of guy not likely to be hired here. Inside these halls, the business of Disney is, of course, business, and Roy Disney is viewed essentially as a man who only gets in the way. His critics at the company point out that he earned his job only on family connections, and resists innovation in favor of recycling the long-vanished past. For instance, his recent pet project, Fantasia 2000, a remake of the 1940 masterpiece that remains a coup of modernist experimentation, garnered admiring reviews, but was one of the company's biggest ever failures, with losses of around $100 million. Disney executives also fault Roy for his frequent assaults on the machinery of merchandising. They tell, in ominous voices, the story of the white Mickey. Last year, the Disney store offered for sale a white plush Mickey, a seasonal venture intended to capitalize on snowy Christmas. Roy says he felt it represented an affront to the integrity of the mouse, who historically has appeared in red shorts, his ears two black orbs. He called Eisner on multiple occasions to voice his displeasure and demand a meeting. The portrait sketched by the Disney team characterizes Roy Disney as a grating nuisance when he is around and an even bigger problem when he is not. Some say his frequent disappearances to his home in Ireland have made him the most inaccessible of executives. If Roy was in charge of this company, one top executive told me, the Walt Disney Company would not be a company today, but an understaffed library in a small room at some university. These days, now that he has been exiled from the gated and heavily secured grounds of the Disney Company headquarters, Roy Disney works out of a nondescript, low-slung building in another part of Burbank. It houses Shamrock Holdings, an investment company he founded in 1978 to manage his inheritance and savings, Disney stock worth some $50 million, a sum he has since multiplied many times over by acquiring and backing all sorts of companies. When you step into the lobby at Shamrock, you find yourself standing in a Japanese-style rock garden, complete with a waterfall and a pool glittering with the golden scales of Gaoa fish. A metal sculpture of a Buddha presides over the scene, and it might seem puzzling that a company that engages in corporate takeovers would present itself as some housing. Upstairs, on the second floor, Disney emerged in the reception area, dressed casually in a blue sweater, khakis, and scuffed sneakers. Asked if there was any truth to the white Mickey story, he quickly confirmed its veracity, while expressing dismay over other products offered for sale at the Disney store. "I didn't like the brown plush Mickey," he said. "It looked like it had been in the toilet." Told that his critics describe him as an inattentive executive fond of flying off to Ireland, he looked hurt. "You can do an awful lot without appearing to be in perpetual motion," he said. "Most of what you do occurs inside your head, and it doesn't matter where you are when you do it. The appearance of, gosh, I am awfully busy, I just have minute for you, is largely phony anyway." Disney might be called a beta man who surrounds himself with uncommonly fierce alpha personalities. At home, he has Patty, his outspoken wife and gatekeeper, to use her own word, and in the office he has Stanley P. Gold, the president and chief executive of Shamrock Holdings, and a former Disney board member who has helped engineer the campaign against Eisner. When I ducked into Gold's office at Shamrock for a scheduled interview, he was sitting in a cloud of cigar smoke, his eyes hooded with suspicion. During our meeting, we talked about Troy Disney's philanthropic activities, a subject that Disney himself had brushed off. Yet he has donated upward of $8 million to the Walt Disney Concert Hall, the new home of the Los Angeles Philharmonic. His gift was earmarked for a separate, smallish theater within the complex that serves as a downtown venue for the California Institute of the Arts, the art school in Valencia, of which Disney has served as chairman. He also gives heavily to environmental causes, like the Peregrine Fund in Boise, Idaho. He has served as chairman of that, too. Revealingly, the peregrine falcon is a paradox, the most vulnerable of predators. The falcon is the first species to die when the forest begins to crumble and there is no life to feed on, Gold explained. You can tell when an ecosystem is about to collapse when the falcon cannot provide for itself. Oya Disney was born in 1930 and grew up as an only child in Tranquilta Luca Lake with his future wife as a neighbor. My first memory of Patty, he says, is of a little girl with pigtails throwing clumps of dirt at me as I went off to the Toluca Lake Boys Club on Saturday mornings in a station wagon. The image might seem to suggest an affection for female aggressors, and indeed Roy fondly characterizes his mother as his first detractor. He considered her great character, the sort of matriarch who would suddenly give you a look and blurt out, "That's a funny looking coat you're wearing." His father, by contrast, was more supportive, the gentlest of the four Disney brothers. Walt and my father's other brothers would gather in our backyard every Sunday and play croquet, Roy recalls. It was vicious. Disney Brothers, as the company founded by Walt and Roy O. Disney was originally named, was founded in the fall of 1923, in the rear of a cramped real estate office in Hollywood. Walt was the creative genius, with all that implies about brutal egotism, while Roy, 8 years older, was the one who lost sleep over budgets and kept the company solvent. In the beginning, financial problems were so severe that the two brothers had to mortgage their houses to pay for Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs 1937, the world's first full-length animated feature, and, as it turned out, an overnight sensation that provided them with the money to build the studio in Burbank. Snow White was perfect, the younger Roy Disney says. It had to be. Walt was ruthless with it. There is not a wasted motion in that film. In 1954, after graduating from Pomona College in Claremont, California, with a major in creative writing, Roy joined the family business. His father, he recalls, was worried that Walt would be tough on me, and indeed his employment with his tyrannical uncle did not begin auspiciously. He was sent off to Salt Lake City and spent a year in the wilds of Utah and Wyoming, working as a cameraman on a movie called Perry, the story of a female squirrel trying to survive in the forest. It was based on a novel by Felix Salten, who was also the author of Bambi, but live-action footage of squirrels turned out to be no match for the beloved animated deer. One winter weekend, eager to take a respite from chasing after forest critters, Roy flew home to Toluca Lake, and his mother met him at the airport. She thought it was time that he settled down, and to his surprise, she brought along a young woman she felt would make a suitable wife for him. Patty Daly was no longer a schoolgirl in pigtails. When Roy stepped down from the plane and onto the tarmac, his mother firmly instructed him, "Kiss her, Roy." 6 months later, he proposed marriage. Too timorous to pop the question in person, he sent off a 5-page letter from Salt Lake City that covered all manner of irrelevant subjects, before ending with an awkwardly phrased but all-important sentence. Without hesitation, Patty picked up the phone to accept. "Roy wasn't home when I called," she recalls. "He was out at the movies." In October 1954, Disneyland premiered on ABC, and the show became an instant institution. On Wednesday nights, families gathered in their knobby pine dens to watch the mustachioed Walt Disney preside over a variety show that featured a mix of cartoons, documentaries, and nature stories. Roy Disney had been assigned by his uncle to assist with the nature shorts, the 16mm True Life Adventures, as they were known. For the next 20 years he diligently labored on films like An Otter and The Family and the Owl that didn't give a hoot. Yet after the death of Walt Disney in 1966, and of his own father 5 years later, Roy found himself pushed into insignificance at the company. I suggested a couple of features that I thought would be good movies, and got turned down, he recalls, prompting him to quit his job in 1977, while keeping his seat on the Disney board. It was a painful separation. I wasn't sure what to do with my life, he says, adding that he consulted a psychiatrist, and made one movie on his own, a documentary about yacht racing, before deciding to give up the creative life and become a full-time investor. Oddly, it was not until 1984, when Eisner arrived at Disney, that Roy was persuaded by the new chief to return to the company and head the animation division. Roy had just spearheaded the Bow Room coup that had installed Eisner in a fancy new job of his own. At the time, the Disney studio was faltering and desperate to revive its faded glory. And soon it actually did. Over the next decade, baby boomers, who harbored fond memories of seeing Dumbo and Pinocchio as children, descended on new multiplex theaters with their own children to snack on overpriced popcorn and enjoy what amounted to a second wave of animated masterworks. It started in 1989 with The Little Mermaid, which was followed by Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, The Lion King, and last, and most assuredly least, Pocahontas. The Disney Renaissance owed a good deal to Jeffrey Katzenberg, then the chairman of the studio, and an intense, driving presence, whom the actor Alec Baldwin once described as the eighth dwarf, greedy. Katzenberg made a wise decision when he enlisted the help of the songwriter Alan Menken, a stylish, sometimes slick composer who removed the tinkling sounds from children's movies and replaced them with big-hearted, rousing rhythms. The new Disney films were essentially animated Broadway musicals, and fittingly, some of them ended up as actual plays on Broadway. The creative boom ended in 1997 with the release of Hercules, a critical and commercial dud, whose mythological hero told too many lame jokes and generated too much unwanted merchandise. I remember coming into the office and seeing all the stuff for Hercules piled up, Roy Disney says. Every tag said, Disney's Hercules, and the word Disney was bigger than the Hercules. It was bad taste. It was a me Tarzan thing. It was a disaster. Lately, the Walt Disney Company has been unable to replicate its earlier successes in the realm of hand-drawn animation, and the truth is that it has virtually stopped trying. It permanently closed its studio in Orlando in January, reducing the number of artists working in animation from a peak of 1,805 years ago to about 600 today, all of them based in Burbank. Since 1991, Disney has lived at least partly on borrowed glory, blithely picking up prizes for films by Pixar, which created Toy Story, A Bug's Life, and most recently, Finding Nemo, an underwater fable drenched in movies like Blues and Oranges. Nemo offered proof that computer-generated animation can hold its own in visual opulence beside the hand-drawn CELS of the past. Now that the talks with Pixar are off, Disney is hoping to reclaim its old eminence in animation all by itself, a daunting task that depends to a large extent on the variable and unaccountable ways of artistic talent. Merchandising. After all, is not everything you do need something to sell, preferably something of merit? The first test will come in 2005, when Disney is scheduled to release an animated film still veiled in secrecy. Chicken Little, as it is tentatively titled, was described to me by Roy Disney as a computer-generated John Lasseter ripoff, if you will. Lasseter is the creative director of Pixar, and much is riding on Eisner's first challenge to his supremacy. If Chicken Little succeeds, it will prove to stockholders as well as to those of us whose investment in Disney is purely emotional that the sky above the Walt Disney Company is not falling after all. In the meantime, Roy Disney keeps busy with his own projects. There is, for instance, the completion of Destino, an animated short that began in 1946 as a collaboration between Walt Disney and, of all people, Salvador Dali. On the surface, you might not think of them as similarly inclined visual artists. Walt, after all, was a Chicago-born animator and political conservative who wanted to reach the widest and most democratic of audiences, while Dali was an avatar of the European avant-garde who sought to offend with the form of shock treatment known as surrealism. But today, in a world that largely ignores the old divide between high art and popular culture, we can see how much they had in common. Both men were in love with fantasy. And both had famous mustaches. You could even argue that Disney's Fantasia owes as much to the irrational juxtapositions of surrealism as Dali's melting watches owe to cinematic animation. Who can deny that they were misjudged in their lifetimes? Disney, in fact, was the most radical and visionary of artists. He created museum-quality art in a communal studio setting, while Dali was the most eager of crowd pleasers. They hit it off because they were both great self-promoters, Roy Disney observed with a chuckle. Dali was around the studio for 8 or 9 months making this film, which at some point got stopped, probably because there was no money in it. It remained unfinished until last year, when Roy Disney took it upon himself to rescue the storyboards from storage and turn them into edited footage, at a cost he estimates of about $1 million. When I asked if I could see Justino, we descended to his basement den, where he keeps a jumbo screen. The walls of the room were cluttered with framed family photographs, many of them black and white, and the ghostly, beneficently smiling faces of his father and mother, along with those of his uncle Walt and Aunt Lillian, appeared to gaze down on him as he popped a DVD into a slot, flicked off the lights, and did a craze dash for the couch, as if eager not to miss one nanosecond of a film he had already watched, by his own estimation, at least a few hundred times. The opening credits flashed on the screen, pairing Walt Disney's rounded, bouncy signature with Dali's pricklier one. It quickly became evident that Destino is a minor masterpiece of surrealism. Genuinely startling. The 6.5-minute film follows a fairy princess with swirling black hair as she floats through a series of dream landscapes reminiscent of Dali's earliest and most haunting paintings. "I think we have a shot at the Academy Awards with this," Roy said, as he turned the lights back on. A week later, lo and behold, the film actually made the list of Academy nominees in the category of Best Animated Short. So next Sunday night, when you turn on your TV, you can look for Roy and Patty Disney doing their little waltz down the red carpet. Hooray for them. Applause, please. Perhaps happy endings do exist after all. Or perhaps not. It has been exactly 50 years since Roy entered filmmaking with the ill-fated Perry, and over the decades, prizes and honors have tended to elude him. Although Mysteries of the Deep, a film for which he wrote the script, was nominated for an Oscar in 1959, it lost out to a nature short by Jacques-Yves Cousteau. Of all his films, Disney told me, it remains his sentimental favorite. "I found a copy of it after I returned home to New York, and was surprised to see that its message remains timely." Mysteries of the Deep is not an animated film, but a so-called true life adventure. Set below the surface of the ocean on a patch of coral reef, the film tracks an inordinately hungry jawfish on its daily rounds. By the end, you come to understand how the big fish eat the little fish. Deborah Solomon, a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, is working on a book about Norman Rockwell,